dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as, well, an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has not only uncommon intelligence himself, but good intelligence sources is our first guest. He is Kenneth Timmerman, an extraordinarily accomplished investigative reporter and the president and CEO of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran, in connection with whose work he was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. He is an accomplished author as well as journalist. He has written a number of books, including several that deal with the problem that I want to have him talk about a little bit today, which is the as yet undisclosed story behind the murderous attack on American diplomatic personnel and security guards in Benghazi back during the Obama-Biden years, the subject of his book Deception, The Making of the YouTube Video Hillary and Obama Blamed for Benghazi. Ken Timmerman, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome back. There's so much to talk with you about. I did want to ask you about what you have found and what the public has not yet been fully read in on concerning Iran's involvement in the run-up to that attack in Benghazi, and give us a sense of what we have a need to know about all of that.
Well, Frank, I first became aware of the Iranian involvement on the ground in Benghazi really at the beginning of the Libyan civil war in 2011. I write about that in my first book on Benghazi, which is called Dark Forces. I was starting to get text messages and then voicemail and then voice calls from a old friend of mine who was a military contractor. He was in Benghazi assisting U.S. forces on the ground and doing other stuff. And he said, what are all these Iranians doing here walking around? I said, well, gee, I don't know. What are they doing? And he said, so he went on to describe, and I got, you know, updates periodically. They had sent essentially Quds Force officers to Benghazi early on to launch their own pickup team, their own little militia that later would be the militia, Ansar al-Sharia, that attacked the consular facility and the CIA base in Benghazi in 2012.
So this is the Quds Force, and again, you might want to describe who those characters are and their ties directly to the Iranian regime, and then introduce us to what that militia wound up doing on the occasion of this attack in Benghazi.
The Quds Force is the overseas operational arm of Iranian government terrorism. They are part of the Revolutionary Guards Corps. They were run since their inception, really, by Qasem Soleimani, who met his maker and is burning forever on January the 1st in early January at over New Year's in Baghdad. He was the Iranian general in charge of the Quds Force. They sent operational teams to Benghazi to recruit terrorists. When the attacks actually took place, they were on the ground supervising them. My sources say that they were also the ones who actually fired the mortars that killed our two U.S. Navy SEALs who were killed that night during that 13-hour battle. As one U.S. military officer who was there on the ground told me, there's nobody in Libya who has that kind of mortar skills. It simply wasn't there in the Libyan army. It wasn't there among any of the jihadis. But the Iranians have tremendous experience with all forms of artillery from their eight-year battle with Saddam Hussein. So they were deeply engaged in all of this. They're the ones who crafted the operation. They funded the operation. In this new article in the New York Post, I revealed for the first time finance documents that show their involvement in this. And all of this surely was available to the U.S. government and yet was never examined by Trey Gowdy or any other investigative committee that has been looking into Benghazi.
Well, this is fascinating. If that information about direct Iranian regime culpability in the murder of an American ambassador and several others in Benghazi was available to the United States government, why would the Obama-Biden administration not have wanted that to be made known to Congress or to the public more generally?
Well, it would have been an act of war by the Iranians, and that would have frustrated Obama's longstanding and really self-avowed goal of making peace with the Iranian regime, which ultimately he did in 2015. Imagine the Iran nuclear deal if the American public was saying, well, the Iranians have conducted a state-sponsored terrorist attack against us that cost the lives of an ambassador and three other Americans in Benghazi. You're not going to talk to the Iranian regime. It would have killed his talks with Iran. So he didn't want that to come out, number one. Number two, remember, it was just weeks before the 2012 election. It would have showed how weak Obama was, and he didn't want that to happen. The third, this is really tremendously important. Even today, I went to Trey Gowdy's committee with the documents that I had, which I had gotten from Iranian sources, and I learned in the meantime that there were lots of U.S. government documents about the Quds Force involvement in those attacks. And I was told, Ken, we're not going to touch this. We've been told it's way too classified, and Representative Gowdy doesn't want to go down that. He just wants to look at Hillary's involvement and get over that, focus on that. And I said, wow, but you're going to miss 3/4 of the truth. Yeah, Hillary was involved. Obama was involved. They were culpable for not responding. But there was a state sponsor behind this. Nobody wanted to hear it.
This is a scandal of the first order, Ken Timmerman. And just very quickly, is there any question in your mind that Joe Biden would have known about the true source of this attack about the time that it happened?
There were only a half a dozen people who knew, I believe, in at the political top summit of government. Obama, Biden, for sure, Hillary Clinton, and John Brennan. And many others did not know. There's a memo that I have in Deception, and you can find that at my website, kentimmerman.com. I posted it there on blog page, which is the second page, but kentimmerman.com. There was a memo that the head of DIA sent out to his people right after the attacks. Remember, Michael Flynn, General Michael Flynn, asking what they knew about the Quds Force involvement and the Al-Qaeda involvement. The response he got, which I got declassified through judicial watch, showed 3 pages about the Quds Force, all redacted except for the words Quds Force involvement. And then 3 more pages about Al-Qaeda, most of it redacted, but a few lines that came through. So they knew, even in the intelligence community, within weeks after the attacks had happened. And they were muzzled, they were kept quiet.
Ken Timmerman, thank you for the good piece in the New York Post on the 22nd of August. I hope people can check that out as well, presumably at kentimmerman.com. Keep up the great work, my friend, and come back to us soon. We've got a lot more to talk about the election of 2020 and the work you're doing there as well. Next up, we'll speak with Sam Faddis. We'll get into, with him, the revolution here in America and who's behind it and how they're being funded. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined by a regular contributor to this program, I'm very pleased to say. Charles Sam Faddis is his name. He has worked under other names, undercover for the Central Intelligence Agency, among other services he's rendered to our country. He was also, of course, the man in charge of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Terrorism Unit at the Central Intelligence Agency for a time. A man of many parts, Army officer, as well as a congressional candidate, as well as an author, as well as an essayist, now published at his own platform, and magazine.com, which is a terrific resource. I've been pleased to be on it myself from time to time. Sam Faddis, it's so good to have you. Welcome back. I wanted to talk about a couple of pieces you've had in recent days, Sam, at AND Magazine, and that's again andmagazine.com, including one that really laid out, you've actually had, I think, two now, describing the nature of the revolution that is upon us inside America. I'd like you to talk a little bit about that, why you think that's an apt way of describing what's afoot, and your insights into who's perpetrating this.
Right. Well, I mean, I think most Americans sort of are left with this impression that we have some sort of protest that's more or less spontaneous, looking for some sort of limited reform. And beyond that, if there's anything behind this, money, et cetera, that it's kind of mysterious. And we have no idea where this is all coming from. None of which is true, all of which is, I would say, a product of the fact that at best the media is incompetent and much of it is in the tank for the folks in the street. I mean, what we have is an expressly Marxist revolution. To grab a hold of a specific, we have an organization called Refuse Fascism, which was established a few years ago, which is basically the umbrella organization for all Antifa movements in the country. That is a direct creation of the Revolutionary Communist Party of the United States. That's not supposition. That's not a rumor. You can go to the Revolutionary Communist Party of the United States' website and establish that because they have declared that openly. This is organization is exactly what it sounds like. It is an explicitly communist organization that wants to eliminate the entire democratic system, capitalist system in the United States, and replace it with a dictatorship of the proletariat. This is as old school as it gets. They've actually published.
And as you say, they're not making any secret about this. This is out there for anybody willing to look for this evidence, right?
They 100%. They have, in fact, published an entire constitution for the New Socialist Republic of North America, which is their name for what the country will be called when they're done. That's online. You can find it. You can read the whole thing. As we've written at AND, some quotes, it's as clear as it could be. It's straight out of Stalinism, and it is expressly communist. Dictatorship of the proletariat. The Revolutionary Communist Party of the United States will control every law enforcement, national security apparatus. And then if you shift from there to look into where the money's coming from, these guys get money through an organization called the Alliance for Global Justice, which was created basically by a couple of veterans of the movement to put the Sandinistas in power in Nicaragua. And if you start looking where the money comes from into that alliance, it comes from a whole bunch of other groups, which are friends of Cuba, friends of North Korea, friends of Iran.
Communist China, perhaps?
Well, they don't expressly say that, but I tell you what, the Babakian, who is the head of the Revolutionary Communist Party of the United States, is clearly a Maoist. He, in fact, another one of these where they're not hiding this. You can go online and find an interview on YouTube where he's talking expressly about communist China and Mao. And what a great talking about millions of people killed under Mao Zedong and singing Mao praises and basically saying, you know, a few million people had to die, but in the long run, it was better for everybody.
The old, you have to break a few eggs to make an omelet, right?
That is exactly what he is saying. And he's not hinting around the edges at it. It just hammers away at the point minute after minute after minute. There is no question about where these guys are.
And there's also the Tides Foundation. Tell us a little bit about the role that it's playing. Who are they and how much money are we talking about, do you think?
Well, we're talking the exact numbers as yet opaque, but we're taking a hard look at that and trying to run this down. We are talking millions and millions and billions of dollars that are flowing. And there's another aspect of this that we're starting to dig into, which is maybe worshipfuling is the extent to which maybe some of major American corporations have donated to this, feeling like that. They have poured money into this alliance, thinking, demonstrating that they're woke, in effect, paying for an attempted communist takeover of the United States.
And between them, by some estimates, there's been over $1 billion committed to Black Lives Matter. How does it fit into all of this? Are you saying, Sam Faddis, that Black Lives Matter, the organization, not everybody who professes that to be true, but the organization run by Marxists, self-proclaimed, trained Marxists, they too are in the midst of this revolutionary moment and the communists behind it?
Without question, there is no ambiguity here. This is, and what everybody really understands is that all these groups, Black Lives Matter, Antifa, and all the associated splinter organizations, this is an expressly Marxist agenda. There's nothing here that is limited to police reform. This is the destruction of the existing order and the creation of something entirely new, and something that the vast majority of Americans have no interest in whatsoever and don't understand that it's being pushed on them.
It's so vital that they hear this message, and I appreciate so much, Sam, you're laying it out as clearly as you have. And for more details on all of this, I encourage everyone to please go to andmagazine.com. I did want to ask you, Sam, have you seen this video that is on the internet now that apparently is the sort of soup to nuts version of what happened when this so-called Patriot Prayer individual was murdered in Portland over the weekend? Have you seen that video about the operation that seems to have led up to that and what went down?
I have. I've watched multiple times.
You're a professional in this business, I think it's fair to say, fortunately working for the good guys in various difficult parts of the world in your previous life as a clandestine officer of the Central Intelligence Agency. What did you make of what is putatively a professional hit that apparently the individual shown on camera as having murdered this pro-Trump individual, as he's been described, who's now been killed in the course of an effort to apprehend him by federal authorities just in the past 24 hours.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have had substantial experience with exactly this kind of thing. In fact, I cut my teeth working against Marxist anarchist groups in Southern Europe back in the day. I think what you see in that video is precisely what is described. This is clearly an orchestrated, very well executed assassination. This is not, it was not an accident, and this was the result of a confrontation, and it's very clear. And the way the people move on the street, frankly, just takes me back to things that I saw firsthand decades ago. They killed this in cold blood.
And they did it in a manner that was intended to try to cover their tracks, even though this cameraman was recording the whole thing, as I say, from the setup to the individual coming in and policing up the two shells that had been left on the ground, and of course the exfiltration. Also, Sam, interestingly enough, reportedly a very sophisticated disinformation operation that was part of this. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is part and parcel of all this kind of Marxist operations. It's not just a physical action on the street. It's that it is planned out in advance precisely what the narrative will be, how it will be spun, what will be said. I mean, when you watch that video of that cameraman and you listen to him talking clearly for the benefit of bystanders to explain why he's wandering around with a camera, and then you see him set up with the view of the box and then just hold the picture and, you know, watch a murder react, that no reaction, no emotional reaction stands there, calm as can be, filming the entire thing. I mean, there's no ambiguity here about what happened.
In fact, I thought one of the most, well, and I gather there were people on the ground telling the police, so he looked different than he did, the shooter, that is, and that he went the other way rather than the way he actually went. And the most interesting piece of the whole thing, I must tell you, Sam, I thought was the exchange with some bystander who said, hey, you filmed this whole thing. You need to get that to the authorities. And There's no interest in doing that on the part of the cameraman. Sam, we have to leave it at that. So much more to talk with you about this revolution. Who's doing it? Marxists, communists, people determined to destroy our country, as well as now the evidence that they're moving into a different phase where it will be targeted and very deadly violent acts in the mix. We appreciate both your insights into all of this, Sam, as well as what you've done to try to protect us from enemies, foreign and domestic. I know you'll keep up the good work at andmagazine.com, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Next up, we'll speak with Jeff Nyquist. We'll take stock with him on the ideological impetus behind all of this and what it's likely to mean for all of us. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's time for one of the high points of our week, our visits with J.R. Nyquist, better known to his friends as Jeff Nyquist, an extraordinary author. These days you can find his writings at jrnyquist.blog. Also, the author of a number of important books, including The Origins of the Fourth World War, and most recently, The Fool and His Enemy. It's always a bracing conversation with Jeff, and it'll be particularly so because I want to drill down with him a bit on some of the things that Sam Faddis was warning about in the last block, and it's great to have you with us for that purpose. Jeff, thank you so much for taking some time. So the predicate for this conversation has been set by my chat with Sam, Jeff, and you didn't hear it, but the gist of it was we're in the midst of a revolution. With Marxists, including Maoists, meaning Chinese Communist Marxists, using these various groups, Antifa and Black Lives Matter and Freedom Road Socialist Organization and the Revolutionary Communist Party of the United States and others, to bring about an outcome that I think most people listening, even to this program, and I'd like to think that people listening to this program are way above average and certainly have been exposed to a lot of information from you and others that would make them probably more prepared to accept what the rest of us probably would find completely incredible, and that is that a relatively small number of people think they're going to turn this into a socialist republic, or more to the point, a communist one. Talk us through, based on your extensive study of these kinds of individuals and their ideology, why they think that might just be possible and how serious they are about trying to accomplish it.
Yeah, they are deadly serious. And what we have is we have a class of people who are dedicated to this revolution. But the vast majority of people in society, they're busy with their lives, with the, you know, raising their children, having careers, having jobs, you know, the normal struggles of life. And so all they hear in the background is the messaging, and very much it's messaging. And communism is a very complicated, you could say communism ideologically, is a moving target, in that it is always giving itself a facelift, changing the formula, the Marxist formula, to being about women, to being about race, to being about the environment, so that you're no longer recognizing it as a communist message, as a revolutionary message, but always these themes, it's anti-capitalism. And of course, the whole idea behind the message is the seizure of power. If you read Marx, Lenin, Stalin, etc., it is all about the revolution, and the revolution is the seizure of power. So you could look at every trick in the book that they do to infiltrate capitalism, to infiltrate the schools, the universities. All of a sudden, we find ourselves with institutions that have communists in them, that have this new way of speaking that make them sound like Democrats concerned with the environment and prejudice against people of color. But in reality, the color they're really interested in is red.
This is, I guess, a tradecraft question, Jeff. Besides trying to sort of obscure their intentions. And to some extent, as Sam was pointing out, they don't even really do that in a lot of cases. But apart from, you know, using deflective techniques of focusing on the racism of the country or what have you, how is it, going back to, I guess, Lenin, that a small number of people, some of them, yes, burrowed into institutions, but whether they are or whether they're not, they're able to accomplish over the opposition of large numbers of others the end states they seek?
It's because we have in our heads a myth called democracy. Look, over 100 years ago, Robert Michels wrote a very famous book in political science called Political Parties, in which he said that all political systems are oligarchical, which means it's a very few people that really control every kind of system. And the discovery that the communists made, particularly Marx, was the capitalist, the open society, the free society, its oligarchy is not exactly very attentive to internal threats, because it assumes that everybody is happy, that people are free, that they can do what they want. Why would they revolt? And of course, the communists then understand perfectly well that since everything is really in the political sphere is managed by elites, because look, 95% of the population, what they do every day has nothing to do with politics. It never touches their lives. I mean, maybe it's 98%. You know, whoever did the study, it's a very small group of people that make the government, that make government, you know, function, that control it, and that keep its policies moving. So it only takes a very small number to displace that other small number if they use the right tactics.
So, Jeff, talk a little bit about what those tactics are, because I think if we look for them, we'll find them all around us at the moment.
Yes. Well, controlling the media or influencing the media and its messaging is very important. Creating a general line that draws in large numbers, see, since most of the people, you know, 95 to 98% of the people aren't paying attention that closely, you can then create messages that appear to be, oh yeah, I care about the environment too. Oh yeah, I don't want, you know, Black Lives Matter to me too. But these messages are subversive of the people's liberties, and they are a chance then to propose legislation, to get politicians elected, to get people on city councils and boards of supervisors, and start taking control locally and otherwise through legislation that is cunningly designed to restrict freedom and to prevent, in the end, opposition. That is a kind of gradualistic takeover. And by getting people to believe this set of themes, then anybody who then says, wait a minute, these people are communists, and they go, no, you're a racist, you're against the environment, you're for pollution, you know, and then it's like, oh my gosh, who wants to be, you know, in that position? So everybody keeps their mouth shut and goes, well, you know, nobody will understand me if I come and say they're communists, because everybody says, no, he's just for the environment. He wants to stop global warming. He wants to prevent black citizens from being killed by the police. So this is kind of the dynamic that they've set in motion. Tactically, that's one of the tactics through the media. Another one of the tactics that they use, of course, is they actually infiltrate government schools and universities. They have a lot to say about our education process. And this is a two-step thing. Not only do they cultivate certain young people, they advance certain careers. I saw when I was in the university, they were sending people that they believe, young people that were going to be dedicated communists, to the John F. Kennedy School of Government and other prestigious schools, where they would then easily get into whatever branch of government in the bureaucracy that they wanted them to get into. And of course, they were taking over the campuses when I was in graduate school 30 years ago. And it was a kind of a gradual process. And in this gradual process, we find ourselves here with Marxist youth in the street, with the universities just incapable of listening to any other point of view, with conservatives really persecuted in universities and in the government. So many of these people in our government, with their mentality shaped by this, that they that they've gone after the president on false charges. The intelligence community has done, instead of the intelligence community looking out for these revolutionaries, it's claiming the president is a Russian agent for the last, you know, 3 years or so, and well, 4 years, basically. But it's astonishing.
Jeff, there's one other technique, obviously, at work here. In its most benign form, it's a sort of coercive practice of so-called political correctness to silence people into going with the program, or at least not standing up against it. And then increasingly, as we talked about with Sam a moment ago, there's now directed violence being used, including an assassination, apparently, in Portland, Oregon. Talk about how those fit into the communist playbook for achieving dominance over a large number of people who otherwise wouldn't dream of being communists or the servants of it.
Right. Well, Trotsky even wrote a book, Communism and Terrorism. Terrorism is an aspect of communism. Marx bragged about it when a jury got him off for his activities around the time of the 1848 revolution. When he was kicked out of Germany, he said something to the effect that, you know, you're stupid, you let me off, I wouldn't let you off, you know, we will expose, you know, we will extend our terrorism to you too, as communists. Terrorism is intrinsic to this because they believe in order to change society, they have to, as Engels famously said, annihilate, exterminate whole classes and races of people. And this is, I'm not making this up, this is in the Marxist-Leninist repertoire. And when you see what they did when you have Stalin come along and Mao and Pol Pot, no, this is part of the pattern.
It's the practice. And this is the point. Folks, if you're listening to this program and you're hearing about what is afoot now, this isn't just in prospect, this is happening in America now, you're on notice that worse is to come. If we're not careful, those involved in these kinds of revolutionary activities need to be arrested and prosecuted for treason, it seems to me, sedition, treason, whatever. And if we don't, we will be, I'm afraid, reaping the whirlwind of our passivity and inaction. Jeff Nyquist, thank you for this very important, very sobering call to action. It's vitally needed, and we appreciate you taking the time to do it with us this week. We'll look forward to visiting with you again in the course of next week. Thank you, my friend. Next up, we'll talk about what Chinese communists are doing elsewhere around the world, also to our great detriment, with retired Marine Colonel Grant Newsom, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, I'm pleased to say, with a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, a retired Marine Colonel, a successful international businessman, foreign service officer, and now senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, and I'm thrilled to say, also at the Center for Security Policy. His name is Colonel Grant Newsom. We are privileged to be able to pick his brains from time to time, and I'm very happy to be able to do so today. Grant Newsom, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's terrific to have you, sir. You have been, of course, following matters in East Asia closely for decades, including during your time in the Marine Corps. You have most recently been studying on site the elections that recently took place in South Korea that resulted in outcomes that some indicate were fraudulent, but gave the ruling party of Moon Jae-in a decisive majority in the parliament of South Korea and further impetus behind his agenda. Calibrate for me and our audience, if you would, Grant, what you make of this South Korean President Moon Jae-in and his agenda, the coterie of people around him, and what they're working inexorably to accomplish.
Yes, I think Moon and the people around him, who are particularly interesting, these are leftists, and that's putting it charitably. Many of them come from the very anti-American, almost pro-communist, pro-North Korea, radical student movement from 30 plus years ago. And from their perspective, that, you know, I think one can reasonably say that they see South Korea's future as being unified with North Korea and aligned, the country aligned with China. And the United States is seen as something, as a problem that actually keeps the peninsula divided. That's almost a colonial power. They see the Japanese as the American front. And that's a perspective which is not often understood, but it's not hard to recognize when you just do some research.
What Moon Jae-in has in mind, as I understand it, is unification with the North on very different terms. Is that right? And what are they?
Yes, well, I would suggest it is unification, to bring the two places together. But his objective is really to transform South Korea and a unified peninsula into a one-party state that reflects what all one-party states are: authoritarian, anti-consensual government, anti-democracy, etc. And you look at how he's gone about it, and it's a process that's been in the works for a number of years, even before he took over in 2017. It's been a gradual taking over, sort of packing of the judiciary, the intelligence services, academia and labor has always been on his side. Yes, the media has been quashed pretty well, and even the opposition has been just sort of worn out. And the National Election Commission, which is particularly important because it runs the elections, has also stacked with Moon's people. So you're taking over the levers of governance that really allow you to dominate, control the society, the political world. And what it reminds me a bit of is Turkey after Erdogan came to power, or Venezuela after Hugo Chavez was elected. This gradual strangling of consensual government. And yet, as that process took place, there's always plenty of people who will say, well, this isn't really outsiders who will say, well, this really isn't what's happening, nothing to worry about. But I think there very much is something to worry about.
Well, and to put a fine point on it, when you talk about a one-party state and when you talk about, you know, a lack of consensual government and so on, it seems as though what you're describing is unification more or less on terms to the liking of the North Korean regime, rather than as in West Germany, the team aligned with freedom and democracy and so on. This is not only an unspeakable prospect for anyone who knows what North Korea is like, of course, but for those who have a memory of the sacrifice made by American servicemen and women to help assure the freedom of South Korea, a freedom that has enabled it to become this incredibly vibrant, democracy till now, and economic powerhouse with huge prosperity for its people. It's just unimaginable. And what I keep hearing, Grant Newsom, is that the people of South Korea don't want to go down this road. This brings me to what we were just talking about with Jeff Nyquist, which is how do communists or totalitarians of other stripes achieve the outcomes that they seek despite the opposition of the majority to them? And to what extent are we witnessing that playing out right now in South Korea?
Well, I think we're seeing it play out. The speed at which it takes place, I don't know, but it is moving that direction. It's worth noting that a sizable chunk of the South Korean population, not a majority, I don't think, but does support Moon. He does have, there is support for his thinking, but there's still plenty of Koreans, probably a majority, who see the sort of what you described as this South Korea, the democratic, free, aligned with the United States as the preferred alternative. But if you get an aggressive, really thoughtful group of revolutionaries who are bent on transforming a society, and if they can get get power by taking over the key sort of levers of society, the political world, the judiciary, intelligence, even the military, academia, labor, etc., that they can really overwhelm the wishes of the majority of the population. And that's something that I think we're seeing. And this recent election gave Moon's camp a sort of a commanding sort of position within the legislature. So it'd be the equivalent of the Republicans getting blown out in both houses of Congress, and really the most extreme end of the Democratic Party taking over. And that's how serious I think this is.
I want to talk with you about this in two respects. First, let's talk about how this was accomplished in South Korea. You addressed this topic in a recent event sponsored by the American Conservative Union, the CPAC folks, the Conservative Political Action Conference, in a U.S. Republic of Korea conference held in Seoul recently. What was done to essentially steal the election in South Korea, Grant?
Well, I think there's a good case, and it's a, I'd say, preponderance of evidence, to my way of thinking, that it was digitally, electronically manipulated using ballot counting machines, QR codes, the National Election Commission central server that had Huawei firewalls, apparently. So digital manipulation, and then what we call regular old counterfeit ballots and stuffing of the boxes. And then huge problems with chain of custody, the moving securely stored ballots here and there, and some other things that that have been raised. And once you look into it and see what evidence there is, it really raises concerns, because I had gone into this saying, let's see what the evidence shows. And I also had a sense, well, maybe it was just a surprise, sort of a Dewey beats Truman or Truman beats Dewey sort of thing. But the more I looked into it, the more concerned I was. And there's one aspect of it, which is just the statistical improbability of the outcome. And you have the people who raise these issues are just regular Koreans, lawyers, professors, statisticians, and very well-regarded, highly respected people, computer scientists, data analysts, computer engineers, politicians, journalists, etc., very regular people who have raised these concerns, and were in the face of opposition from the administration and even from the opposition party itself. So these are real patriots who've raised it, and it really gives you some concern. One of the professors who looked at the statistics described it as throwing a stone at something and hitting it 1,000 times in a row. Another one described the results as artistic and like, if God didn't do it, it was rigged. Once again, this is something that should get the attention of the U.S. government, ought to be looking into these charges and doing some assessment to see. But the foreign media as well, the American media, it'd be nice if they were to pay some attention. Instead, they generally write about K-pop boy bands and rather than the possibility of an American ally slipping away.
Thank you for your time. God bless you, Grant. We'll talk with you again soon. I hope the rest of you will return to us on Monday. Same time, same station. In the meantime, have a good Labor Day. Bless you all. This is Frank Gaffney, over and out.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.